Hello, and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. Today, it's essentially taken for granted that the Republican Party gets between 5 and 10% of the black vote, and less than a third of the Hispanic vote nationally. The Republican Party is an overwhelmingly white party, and that's not the result of happenstance. As my colleague Claire Malone explains in her piece titled The Republican Choice, it's the result of a series of choices spanning decades. Time and time again, when it came to expanding the party's appeal with voters of color or pursuing white voters, the party chose the latter. Claire Malone is here with me to tell that story. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Galen.
Claire, 150 years ago, the Republican Party was in favor of abolishing slavery. And in the first half of the 20th century, plenty of black Americans identified as Republican. So where does the story of the Republican Party becoming a white party begin?
For decades and decades, Republicans, well into the 20th century, really appealed to black voters because they were the party of Lincoln. And it was pretty easy to remind them that, hey, we're the ones who helped you get your freedom. You know, later, a lot of black Republicans would criticize the party line on that because they said, hey, it wasn't your freedom to give. All human beings are free. But if you were looking at voters in the 20s, you would see a lot of black Republicans. And you started to see the party hold less appeal to black voters as the 20th century moved on. So Herbert Hoover ushered in this era of what we now know to be these modern day Republican values of individualism, bootstrapping, you might say. And that was a bit more hostile to a lot of black Americans who were, you know, still only a couple generations out of slavery and obviously more downwardly mobile than a lot of white Americans. Franklin Roosevelt did a lot to bring black Americans into the Democratic Party because of his New Deal programs, that big tent that we think of, you know, working class whites, working class blacks, Northerners, Southerners. Roosevelt did a lot to change the dynamics of partisan politics.
Our problem is to put to work 3.5 million employable persons, men and women, who are now on the relief rolls.
But then as you go into the even the 50s, Dwight Eisenhower won almost 40% of the black vote. So you're still seeing Republicans viewing black voters as very much a winnable constituency.
What would you characterize as the turning point in all of this from the Eisenhower era of winning almost 40% of black voters to a situation where Republicans are hardly winning any black voters at all?
I would pin it down to the Civil Rights Movement and the Civil Rights Act. Up until the mid-20th century, the Democratic Party was really popular in the white South. If you've ever heard that term, Dixiecrats, you know, Strom Thurmond, who we all know to be the sort of very famous segregationist or infamous segregationist, was for many, many years a powerful Democratic politician from South Carolina. And he very famously switched to the Republican Party because he felt that the Democratic Party was being too supportive of racial integration.
He is recommended under the guise of so-called civil rights. And I'll tell you, the American people from one side or the other had better wake up and oppose such a program. And if they don't, the next thing will be a totalitarian state in the United States.
And you saw tons and tons of white Democratic voters in the South say, we want out of this party that is embracing racial equality. And you saw the Republican Party sort of say, oh, maybe we should get those votes. And so in the late 50s, early 60s, late 60s, this is when you see this really intense conversation within the Republican Party saying, do we continue to pursue black votes or do we go and pick up those, frankly, low-hanging fruit votes of white voters in the South who are angry at the Democratic Party and who are looking for a home? Barry Goldwater, who was the Republican Party's nominee in 1964 and lost, I should say, by a pretty big margin.
I have no question that had I voted for that bill, I might have softened some of the Negro opposition to my candidacy, but I'm not foolish enough to think that I would have won over the NAACP. I have to live with myself. And I took
because he was so conservative and a bit of a radical figure to a lot of Americans. But Barry Goldwater's argument to Republicans was, he famously said this line, "We should go hunting where the ducks are." And what he meant was, the Republican Party should stop tending so much to moderate northern constituencies and go to the solid Democratic South that was now looking for new representation and, frankly, racist representation. And that's sort of famously called the Southern Strategy. And that is ultimately what the party embraced.
But Barry Goldwater lost in 1964. So how did the party take away from that experience that it should double down on this strategy? And what did the conflict over whether or not to pursue the strategy further look like?
There was a lot of soul searching in the Republican Party following the 1964 loss. And in fact, you know, in 1966, there's this Time magazine cover that has six Republican rising stars. The tagline in the magazine is "Republican Resurgence." And Ronald Reagan, who was then the governor of California, is on there. But Edward Brooke, who was the country's first black senator since Reconstruction, was on the cover. George Romney, the governor of Michigan, was on there. And in that magazine article, Time writes that the future of the Republican Party is mostly, they said, moderates with immoderate ambitions. So basically, they're saying the party went hardcore conservative with Barry Goldwater in 1964, and that was obviously the wrong direction. The party is now thinking, okay, we got to choose people who are more moderate, who appeal to a wider swath of America in order to compete in 1968. And that is not what happened.
So what did happen?
Richard Nixon, who was a real political animal, understood that while people in the media, while Time magazine might think that moderate was the way to go to win the Republican nomination, he realized that Barry Goldwater was still very popular among that Republican base. And one of the big moderates that had emerged in the Republican Party was George Romney, the Republican governor of Michigan, Mitt Romney's father. And George Romney had been a extremely successful car executive, had won in a Democratic state, was handsome, was earnest, was, you know, all these things that people thought a politician should be.
The Republican Party must promote the program and provide the leadership that will capture the interest, respect, and support of a majority of Americans. I think the future of this...
He was also very racially progressive. He championed civil rights. He was basically a northern moderate. And he was a front runner, I should say, for a while in the campaign. Nixon was not the front runner initially. It was George Romney. But there were also big riots in Detroit. And Romney was the governor of Michigan and eventually had to put down the riots along with help from the National Guard. And Nixon turned that to his advantage. He sort of said, look at George Romney, who, by the way, embraces civil rights for black Americans. He can't keep this American city under control. And as we know, Detroit was also a largely black city. And the neighborhoods that were having these riots were often black neighborhoods. And so Nixon basically pointed to this chaos in many American cities, but in particular in, you know, in Detroit, where Romney had influence. And he said, do you want this guy in charge? And Nixon says, this is a quote from him. He says, quote, "The primary civil right in America was to be protected from domestic violence." And he meant these riots. So this is his famous law and order message. And it was playing on white voters' fear of black Americans. It's interesting, in 1966, that same Time magazine article, the author pointed out that the Republicans kind of had a way in because the Democratic Party's FDR-era coalition was fragmenting. And they said, quote, "Negro militancy has siphoned off much of the support from urban Italians, Irish, and Slavs." And those are the voters that Nixon went after. Whites in the North and the South who were afraid of black Americans getting greater rights and afraid of the disorder and protests and unrest that was happening in the 1960s. And that is why law and order worked as a message in
tonight,
1968.
I again proudly accept that nomination for President of the United States.
But George Romney, as you said, in 1966, was the front runner. In 1964, he was arguing for including a civil rights plank in the Republican Party platform. Clearly, this is a section of the Republican Party. What happened to it in 1968? Did it fight back against Nixon?
What happened at the 1968 convention was that George Romney supporters did try to nominate him to be the vice president at the last minute, because this was back when conventions were actually unpredictable. Their little rebellion was put down by some sort of backroom deals run by the Nixon people, where they got the Southern delegate approved Spiro Agnew to be Nixon's vice president instead. So there were certainly actions that were taken to try to stop that continuation of the Southern strategy. There's a quote from George Romney right after the convention, which was in Miami. He tells reporters, he's speaking to Nixon and Agnew here. He says, quote, "To prevent this abscess from reforming," that abscess being that split between the racist versus not racist strategies, "Nixon and Agnew have to make the party leaders from the states that must win the election for them at least as important as Mr. Nixon made the leaders of the South and the Southwest in winning the nomination." So that's Romney basically saying, Nixon, you have to give credence to the moderate Northerners as much as you're giving these conservative radicals and, yes, racists from the South and in some cases the Southwest. This is Romney, I think, pretty plainly stating after that convention, listen, this is a big problem in the Republican Party, and they've got to patch over that wound, or in the gross metaphor that Romney used, the abscess. And I would argue that abscess never actually went away.
And so how did Nixon respond to that advice? Once nominated, did he do anything to try to engage voters of color? And as the 70s went on, how did voters of color view the Republican Party once the George Romney vision of the Republican Party had kind of faded away?
You do start to see black voters leaving the Republican Party. They're not all necessarily joining the Democratic Party. There's a lot of independent voters. The Republican Party really did tend to its garden in the South, and it wasn't particularly doing a lot of outreach to those voters, which is why after Watergate, you know, another moment of crisis for the GOP, you saw again this little mini emergence of some of those moderate Republicans saying, hey, maybe we should try going after those black voters again. So this is in the late 70s, post Nixon administration, post the wreckage of the party, people saying, okay, maybe we should do the outreach now. And that obviously didn't happen again.
Why not?
Because the party went with Ronald Reagan. There's this really interesting moment in the late 1970s in the Republican Party. In 1978, the Republican Party chairman, Bill Brock, invited Jesse Jackson to speak at an RNC meeting and basically to argue the case that, as Jackson put it, the Republican Party needs black people if it is ever to compete for national office. Jackson made this argument that there were 7 million unregistered black voters who were up for grabs by the GOP. The New York Times said after the meeting that, quote, Jackson's proposition seems realistic enough, given that 30% of Northern and 20% of Southern blacks already consider themselves independents. Jesse Jackson got a standing ovation from this Republican crowd. And talking to the New York Times, this chairman, Bill Brock, said, if the Republicans nominate the right 1980 presidential candidate, they could hope to get anywhere from 30 to 40% of the black vote. That did not happen. Ronald Reagan, a very conservative Republican, was their nominee in 1980, and he only won 14% of the black vote.
What was in it in the late 70s for Jesse Jackson and other African Americans who were encouraging the Republican Party to seek black voters?
Largely, he was worried that if black Americans voted too predictably with the Democratic Party, that the Democratic Party would take their votes for granted and therefore would take their needs for granted. He eventually obviously became a very important figure in Democratic politics, but during this period, he was looking for leverage, political leverage for black Americans to continue this civil rights fight. He was kind of worried about, you know, what we saw happen just a couple months ago. You see Joe Biden, who's on this very popular radio show with a very popular black radio host, and the host is saying, essentially. What are you going to do for black people? And Joe Biden said,
but I tell you, if you have a problem figuring out whether you're for me or Trump, then you ain't black.
And in some ways, that's exactly what Jesse Jackson was worried about in the 1970s, that the Democrats would take black voters so for granted that they would be a foregone conclusion. And, you know, it's not as if there weren't things about the Republican Party of, you know, 1978 or 1980 that couldn't persuade black voters that they had a natural home. You know, you see a 1979 magazine profile of Jesse Jackson, and he is described as being at an anti-abortion rally. I mean, you'll see this later when George W. Bush and Karl Rove say, hey, you know who's a natural conservative? A Hispanic voter in Texas, because they're probably Catholic or very religious and they're anti-abortion. Jackson was sort of emblematic of the idea that lots of Americans had these socially conservative parts of their belief system that the Republican Party could act on electorally.
But that didn't ultimately end up happening. As you said, in 1980, Ronald Reagan only got 14% of the black vote. Throughout the 80s, Reagan had a pretty successful tenure as president. Did he end up appealing to the black community once in office? Or was it essentially acknowledged that the Republican Party didn't need a lot of black voters in order to be successful?
Yeah, it wasn't a particular focus of Reagan's electoral strategy. In fact, there's this 1980 campaign stop that Reagan makes at the National Urban League, which is a prominent civil rights organization. And later on, a Reagan aide said that that stop wasn't so much to win over black voters, but it was to show white moderates and liberals that Reagan wasn't anti-black. So it was this concern not with winning black votes, but proving that Reagan wasn't racist to white moderates who might have said, ooh, I remember Ronald Reagan. Wasn't he kind of a Barry Goldwater, super conservative type of guy? I mean, Reagan's sort of great mythology is that he was uber charming and kind of made people like him, was able to play to these traditionally democratic white ethnic voters in American northern cities, you know, Italian voters, Irish voters, as 1966 Time magazine put it, Slavs. Reagan was winning those people over, and those were voters that he was more concerned with. You know, he wasn't using explicitly racial language, but he was still following the roadmap laid out by the Southern strategy.
It seems like time and time again, the Republican Party considers greater outreach to black voters and voters of color when it's in a situation where it has lost a big election. And so maybe throughout the 80s and through George H.W. Bush's tenure, there wasn't a lot of that same soul searching. So when did the party start again to think about how it might reach out to black and brown voters?
I think you really start to see this during the campaigns of George W. Bush, a two-term Republican president and the last Republican to win the popular vote in 2004. Bush was a very interesting candidate. He branded himself as a compassionate conservative, and he explicitly did so. You know, I talked to Karl Rove, his very famous or infamous, depending on what side you're on, political strategist, and Rove said, you know, that he put that compassionate conservative label on himself to indicate that he was different from previous Republicans. And I think that was because he wanted to appeal to minority constituencies, particularly Hispanic voters, who he had done very well with when he was the governor of Texas. Rove told me, you know, he kind of spoke the bad Spanish, but he was making the effort.
Y también es mi escuela del junior high, también en high school. Estudié español. Es un idioma muy grande.
You know, his kids went to a public high school that had a lot of Hispanic students in Austin, Texas. He was sort of comfortable with that culture and was able to paint himself as this laid-back, compassionate conservative type who wanted to say, listen, I'm not the austerity, scary, old white guy Republican that you're used to. And Bush focused a lot of his, frankly, pre-9/11 politics on domestic issues. No Child Left Behind, which was his marquee education program, was a bipartisan effort. Ted Kennedy, the quote-unquote liberal lion, help put together No Child Left Behind. So Bush initially came in with this kind of, he wanted to soften the Republican Party image. And, you know, actually in 2005, Ken Mellman, who was the RNC chairman and who had been Bush's 2004 campaign manager, he went to the NAACP National Convention and he formally apologized for the GOP's Southern strategy.
Were all of these efforts to soften the GOP's image and reach out to minority voters actually electorally successful? You mentioned that in the past, Reagan's overtures to minority voters may have had more to do with appealing to white moderates than actual minority voters. Was this strategy by Bush successful?
Bush was very successful with Hispanic voters. In his second election, he got almost 40% of the Hispanic vote. So Bush was actually doing pretty well with expanding the Republican umbrella. And it's interesting, you know, I talked to a couple Bush era strategists, Matthew Dowd, Karl Rove, and, you know, they are interestingly very irritated by their historical reputation for having pursued something called the base strategy. The base strategy was this ploy to turn out the Republican base, mostly evangelical voters, by playing up the issue of gay marriage, right? By getting people riled up about that. And Rove and Dowd will tell you, okay, yeah, we did that, but we won the popular vote by also appealing to these different constituencies, these non-traditional Republican constituencies.
There's another element to all of this, which you begin to see emphasized more in the 2000s, which has to do with voting and concerns that there could be potential voter fraud and laws that follow. What happened? Why did the Republican Party become so interested in the possibility of voter fraud?
So I should say, Republican talk about voter fraud certainly did not start with Bush. You can go all the way back to the 1960s and see Republicans saying things about voter fraud in Chicago or other big Democratic cities. There were, frankly, ballot place intimidation squads that Republicans organized to administer literacy tests to voters at largely Black and Latino districts. William Rehnquist, who would go on to become the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, was the leader of one of those essentially ballot security operations, is what they called them, but they were frankly racial profiling operations trying to suppress the votes of minority voters in certain places. It's just the ingrained wisdom now that Black voters or voters of color do not vote for the Republican Party. And from that idea flows a lot of electoral strategy that has to do with, frankly, the suppression of minority votes. You know, in 1980, one of the co-founders of the Heritage Foundation basically said explicitly, we do better in elections when not everyone votes.
I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
So back to the early 2000s. Why did this become such an issue during Bush's tenure?
The 2000 election alerted people to the idea that the mechanics of voting were actually very important to potentially helping determine what votes counted and what votes didn't count. And you go on to see this blossoming during the Bush administration in the Justice Department, in the division that has to do with voting and the administration of the Voting Rights Act. You go on to see a lot of these laws in states that are frankly racially discriminatory or put greater burdens on voters of color. You see those pop up under the Bush administration, basically trying to make it harder for Black people to vote, which, as we all know, is not a new thing in America. The Voting Rights Act and provisions of the Voting Rights Act in particular were at one point in time aimed at making sure that these sort of historically racist areas of the country weren't suppressing the votes of Black voters. And the Bush administration, along with a lot of Republican administrations, has done quite a lot to roll back those provisions. You see, you know, today in places like Georgia, voter roll purges, the closing of polling places in predominantly Black neighborhoods. And you've also seen over the past 10, 15 years, the rollout of these voter ID laws, which really caught on during the Bush administration, starting, frankly, in places like Georgia, And these voter ID laws, which said things that sort of seemed pretty reasonable on the face of things, but they tended to place undue burdens on people who had a harder time obtaining government identification, you know, people who might not have a driver's license or for whom it takes greater effort because they don't have a car or have to use public transportation to get to those places. They were very roundly seen as the solution for a problem that didn't exist, i.e., there actually isn't a lot of voter fraud in the United States. And there was actually this study done by Justin Levitt that looked at the over a billion ballots that were cast between 2000 and 2014. And there were only 31 instances where voter ID could have prevented ballot fraud. So it's a solution in search of a problem, is what a lot of people will tell you.
So help me understand how both things are happening at the same time. One, Bush sees it to his advantage and is actually successful at incorporating more voters of color into the party. And two, his administration is taking actions that work to essentially suppress the vote of people of color. What's going on?
Yeah, it's this kind of double talk. It's the work of the administration versus the work of the campaign. I think kind of what it boils down to in some ways is that Republicans had decided that some minorities, aka Hispanics, were winnable constituencies, and other minorities were not really as winnable, aka Black people. I think Kanye West kind of said it in this very plain way. He sort of spoke the feelings, I think, of a lot of Black Americans in 2005 when he said on this televised fundraiser for Hurricane Katrina victims,
George Bush doesn't care about Black people.
And it kind of became this iconic moment in pop culture history, but frankly, political history. And in some ways, I think the Bush administration had realized that Black voters were too far gone from the Republican Party. But the Hispanic voters were, a lot of them were newer to the country or newer to voting or to the political system, and that they could still be winnable. They didn't have this really ingrained, fraught history with the Republican Party yet. And so during the Bush administration, you saw Republicans playing both sides of that electoral equation. To use the language of a campaign strategist, they were pursuing a couple options. They were doing, you win an election by addition, but also they were influenced by that Republican wisdom of, well, we do better if not everyone votes.
Continuing on a theme, the next time we really see the Republican Party dig deep and think about its relationship with voters of color in America is after another stinging loss, which was in 2012, in which Mitt Romney got 6% of the Black vote and 27% of the Hispanic vote. What do those conversations within the Republican Party look like post-2012?
They were very serious conversations that took a hard look at not only the party's messaging, but some of its fundamental policies. So the party chairman at the time, Reince Priebus, who would go on to become Trump's chief of staff, commissioned this report that was basically like, what did we do wrong? What can we do better? It was officially called the Growth and Opportunity Project, but it was kind of flippantly referred to by a lot of people as the 2012 GOP autopsy report. And I spoke to one of the authors of the report, Henry Barber, who told me that, you know, Reince Priebus called him after the 2012 election and said, basically, we've got to do some soul searching. And that autopsy report was very frank, and I'm quoting from it here. Many minorities wrongly think that Republicans do not like them or want them in the country. And it went on to basically recommend that Republicans be more welcoming to minorities, particularly Hispanics. This was a bit of a reversion to the compassionate conservatism idea of the George W. Bush era. And while the report didn't make specific policy recommendations, it did specifically single out immigration as this place where the Republican Party really needed to do some work to come up with a comprehensive plan that would be palatable to more Americans and, frankly, to Hispanic Americans in particular. And it was seen as this, you know, really important roadmap for the future. And I think we got to remember, when we look at the 2016 primaries, obviously we all know who won, but two of the big candidates in Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio were Hispanic Americans.
What happened between 2004, where Bush is winning almost 40% of the Hispanic vote, and 2012, where Romney is winning only 27%, and 2016, where the party nominates Donald Trump?
For one thing, the country elected its first Black president, and a lot of voters of color were taken with Barack Obama were taken with the idea of an inclusive, a racially inclusive Democratic Party. On the policy side of things, particularly when it comes to Hispanic voters in the Republican Party, moderation on immigration disappeared in a lot of ways during those years. I mean, I talked to Karl Rove and he blamed some of the politics of the Iraq War and Bush's foreign entanglements with killing a lot of bipartisan deals on the domestic front, including immigration. But also, I think you saw the Republican base continue to be pretty anti-immigrant, frankly, in a lot of ways. I mean, you know, there's this 2007 Vanity Fair profile of John McCain, who had become the party's nominee in 2008, who was a senator from a border state in Arizona, basically saying, listen, my base wants the fence. You know, I'll give them the goddamn fence. I don't actually think it works, but I'll give it to them if they want it. You know, McCain wanted a bipartisan immigration deal, and that didn't happen. And so I think you see over the past couple of decades, past couple of presidential elections, the party really shift until you get to 2016 and Donald Trump and the ultimate base strategy campaign. Trump was turning out those people who had been really hardcore, gung-ho, anti-immigration for many, many years. And also, if we hearken all the way back to the Nixonian marriage of Southern whites and Northern whites in this racial bigotry, the low-hanging fruit that is racial politics in the United States, Trump really played to that.
They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people. But I speak to border guards, and they tell us what we're getting. And it only makes common sense.
Where does the party stand today? Because in 2016, President Trump showed that the party doesn't have to do a lot of work to appeal to Black voters or Hispanic voters in order to win a presidential election. Is that accepted as the new wisdom, or is there still a faction of the party that wants to appeal to voters of color?
There's definitely still a faction that wants to appeal to voters of color. There are a lot of people, I think, who are nervous about Trump's performance in November. I mean, frankly, people are worried that with his response to the protests and some of the violence in the wake of George Floyd's killing, there's this feeling of great racial unrest in the country and that Trump isn't very good at dealing with it. Now, let's harken back to Ronald Reagan going to the Urban League to prove he's not racist, or the RNC chairman going to the NAACP to prove he's not racist to moderate white voters. Trump doesn't do that. Trump doesn't even virtue signal to some of these more moderate white voters who might vote for Republicans, who might vote for Democrats, but who are concerned about racism in America. Trump doesn't even throw them a line. He has pursued this overtly racist strategy. And that makes a lot of GOP strategists nervous because Karl Rove said winning the presidency via the Electoral College is a fluke, right? Basically saying you've got to win the popular vote. And how do you win the popular vote? You win the popular vote by appealing to more people than just your base. Trump's base is well tended to by Trump, but Joe Biden, you'll look at current polls, Joe Biden appeals to a lot of those crossover constituencies, some of those white moderates, right? Some of those older voters. And so I think you're seeing a lot of people really nervous about Trump's blind reliance on this turnout the base strategy.
So this is where the Republican Party is now. Some people within the party are concerned. Others seem just as excited as ever about President Trump. Looking back on the 5 decades that we just reviewed, why did the Republican Party make the choices that it did over and over again to get us to the point where we are today?
If I had to boil it down to one sentence, it would be because it's easy. It is easy for the Republican Party to run elections on race baiting issues because America has a huge problem with race. It is a trite thing to say that slavery is America's original sin, that it is a country that is built on this fundamentally flawed and racist history, and that there are a lot of seeds that have been sown over the decades that make it really easy to appeal to white Americans' racism. And what's so interesting about the Southern strategy to me is that it wasn't just something that worked with Southern whites. It worked with Northern whites as well. And that has a lot to do with a lot of those white immigrants coming in from Europe during the late 19th and 20th century. They came to big American cities and they met the Northern migration of freed slaves or the descendants of slaves who were also competing for jobs in these tough cities and economic markets. And you could pit those whites and blacks against each other and very easily sort of bring these racial tensions to the fore. So America has always kind of cultivated these racial tensions. And I think it's very easy to run campaigns on them. I should say that Democrats are in no way excluded from this. You can go back and look at the Hillary Clinton super predator line about black men who were threats during the 90s when everyone was scared about crime.
They are not just gangs of kids anymore. They are often the kinds of kids that are called super predators. No conscience, no empathy. We can talk about why.
That's a race-baiting slogan. This is something that American politicians are very used to doing because our country is a country with huge racial problems. So it's easy to get people's emotions riled up and get them to vote for you if they feel like you're speaking their language on race.
To people who look at Romney and Bush and H.W. Bush and Reagan and maybe say, I didn't see any explicit racism in the way that they campaigned or the way that they governed, what do you say?
Yeah, I mean, listen, the Republican Party, you know, up until Trump, was a little more subtle about the signaling that it did to white voters in certain parts of the country, i.e. they weren't explicitly racist in some of their electoral appeals. But you can look to someone like Ronald Reagan, who did this infamous speech about states' rights in this county in Mississippi that had a lot of lynchings, that was this place of real trauma to black Americans. And Reagan spoke in this very thinly veiled language that nodded to, yeah, I'm still part of the Republican Party that favors the Southern strategy, that is on your side. So it's not as if the Republican Party hasn't in subtle ways been continuing on, you know, with making some of these appeals to white voters based on race.
What about Trump, who says that he's trying to get voters of color into the party, and his strategists who say that they're making headway with young black voters?
Trump is interesting. I mean, Trump actually did a bit better with Hispanics in particular, but some minority communities in 2016 than Romney had done. You know, his campaign is pretty explicit and has been explicit about trying to suppress the black vote in some areas by playing up, let's say in 2016, Hillary Clinton's racist super predator remarks and saying, look, the Democratic Party doesn't like you either, right? So you shouldn't vote. The Trump campaign has done that. Now, as far as Trump's specific appeal to voters of color, particularly younger ones, there is something in that in the sense that Trump in general appeals to Americans who are bogged down by what they perceive as the stiff talk of politicians. They like that Trump is anti-politically correct. There's something that people like about that frank speaking. And I think that that appeal does cross color boundaries, right? Like, it's not just white voters who like it when someone says the uptight liberal media doesn't want you to talk about this thing that everyone talks about, you know, in your life. And it's the thing that you talk about around the dinner table, or it's the language you use around the dinner table. And this president is talking that language. I think a lot of people find that appealing. But I do think that from a strategic point of view, Trump's campaign is not at all counting on black voters to carry them anywhere in 2020 at all.
So finally, looking ahead to the Republican Party 4 or 8 years down the pike, are there people lying in wait to take the Republican Party down a different path to pursue voters of color? What does the Republican Party's future look like when it comes to this question of who it appeals to?
We are in this moment where a lot of people in the GOP are worried about the party once again. You know, I think that's been a little bit of the theme here of these inflection points in the GOP history when it's really considered whether or not it's pursuing the right electoral strategy. And we now find ourselves in a moment of racial unrest in America. Donald Trump is losing by all accounts in the polls. And I think there are a lot of Republican officials, a lot of Republican strategists who are worried about the future of the party, whether or not it can really be competitive and vibrant in its Trumpy state, appealing only to white voters. And so while there might be, you know, Nikki Haley's out there and there might be a Marco Rubio resurgence, there are also a lot of question marks that surround the future of the party. And that does worry a lot of these Republicans in the establishment about, you know, what the next 10 or 20 years of their party could look like.
Claire Malone, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Galen.
To read Claire's article called The Republican Choice, How a Party Spent Decades Making Itself White, go to 538.com. My name is Galen Druk. Jake Arlo helped with production. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.